Blog Talk Radio.
Michael Klagstedt, and I'll be co-hosting tonight's show with Nicholas Brousseau, also the Ethics Talk team. We're here tonight with members of Princeton's ANSCOM Society. Did I pronounce that right, guys?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. And we'd like to talk about the virtue of chastity, sort of have a discussion about sexual themes, chastity, abstinence, these sorts of topics. We'd like to encourage callers tonight, but we ask that you keep your comments especially terse and pointed. You know, please be respectful, as always, but we don't have a lot of time, and we have a lot of callers, so keep them pointed. Any other introductory notes, Nick?
Nope.
Okay. We're joined by Lauren, David, and Shivani. So I'm not sure, you know, how we want to pass off to who, but, I mean, I guess if you feel as though you're the one to answer the question, feel free. I mean, first, I guess we'd just like you to tell us a bit about your society. I mean, why was it formed?
So we were formed in response to a perceived problem on our campus, and that being the hookup culture. So we see the hookup culture, which is, you know, people engaging in acts of physical intimacy with no real intention of commitment anywhere along the line. And we saw that this was a problem because people, by and large, were pretty upset with their involvement in the hookup culture. And after several hookups, people would sort of expect some sort of friendship or commitment, and there just really wasn't any with their hookup partner. So there's a sort of emotional fallout. And so the ANSCOM Society was designed to provide the argument for a different type of lifestyle by focusing on chastity and how this might be a way out of the hookup culture.
Just in terms of historical context, we were founded about 5 years ago in 2005 by Princeton undergraduates. So.
Okay. How did it get its namesake?
So we're named after G.M. Anscombe, who is a Cambridge philosopher, and she sort of returned to talking about virtue and vice and what human flourishing is. She wrote a bit on contraception and chastity and modern moral philosophy, and she just had a very rigorous philosophical engagement with sexual ethics and thinking about sexual ethics in terms of a general approach to what it is that makes a human person flourish.
Interesting. We're all about human flourishing on this radio show. So let me ask you guys, you formed this group in response. I don't know if it was you specifically, but at least you're sort of holding the banner now. You're telling me it was formed a few years ago. In response to this problem of, I guess, promiscuity, and you saw sort of the fallout that it caused. So is this like a registered student organization, or how does that work at Princeton?
Yes, we're an officially registered student group.
We have all the privileges of another type of student group here at Princeton.
That's pretty fair. We have access to university funding, access to university facilities once, you know, we're approved. So. Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
So what do you do with funds, if you do anything at all, to kind of get your message out there? Or what do you do to kind of bring this awareness, I guess, of what you think the hookup culture has, what effect it has on the culture you're in?
Yeah, I guess we do a variety of things at ANSCOM. We sponsor various lecture events. We have speakers come in and talk about things related to abstinence, chastity, family, society. We've had like student debate panels. We've had some kind of, we've hosted seminars.
Speakers event.
Articles. Go ahead, Joe. Yeah, so we publish articles in kind of publications on campus, and as well as kind of made some national media appearances, such as this radio show. So we do a variety of things to try to raise awareness because for a lot of students on campus, Sexual ethics just isn't really an issue that they think about, but it is, in fact, something that's really central to all of our lives.
It's an interesting point you make, because I know at least Nick and I, if not several other members of the ethics team, have been sort of like toying with a sexual ethics show for a while. And you're right. You know, it is one of those things that it's kind of weird in that certain aspects of it are accepted and embraced, but then at the same time, you know, you can't, like, second-guess sexual ethics. You know, it's not appropriate to flesh it out in public and talk about it. It's interesting. It's kind of a double standard. But, yeah, I agree with you there that it definitely needs to be talked about. So
right.
Let me ask
so I definitely want to just commend you guys on your efforts. It sounds like you are pretty organized in what you're doing, and I think it's very cool to have some sort of group where people are at least engaging this topic. Even if, you know, you definitely have your side on the issue, it sounds like, you know, given that you have debates and being on this radio show as well, that you're open to hear the other side. You know, it's not kind of just this type of society that's not looking for somebody's differing opinion, that rather you want to kind of, you know, put your opinion on everybody else. So I just wanted to commend you on that. Well done.
Oh, thanks.
I think should mention too that the Anscombe Society, while many of its members are religious, from lots of different religious backgrounds, lots of different political backgrounds, the Anscombe Society is a philosophical organization that is dedicated to making the reasonable and reasoned case for chastity, regardless of a particular faith, so or lack thereof, so we really tried to approach the culture on through the currency of reasons and arguments.
Yeah,
nice. I'm all about that. That's how things need to be done.
Yeah, we also take the approach of not just philosophy, but a lot of different fields, such as medicine, sociology, etc., can tell us can also point to the same thing that these philosophical reasons are pointing towards. So we also try to bring in a wide variety, experts in a wide variety of topics, so that people can see that this is not just a philosophical view, but a rather comprehensive view about what makes humans happy in the long run. And so all of this is just combined evidence that, when taken together, indicates a particular way of flourishing. And so we just wanted to lay out all of the possible evidence so that people see that chastity is just a part of what it is to be a flourishing human being.
Okay. Well, I guess, I mean, as long as we're here. So it sounds as though you're saying you have a rational basis for which you choose chastity, and you think it's pretty convincing. So let me ask you, I mean, I guess, what is it? Is it a pragmatic position? Like, you feel as though it is best for the mankind in general, or specific individuals, to remain chaste, that this somehow benefits their flourishing?
Sure. So I think, before we get into that, I think it's good to define chastity, because a lot of people often confuse it with abstinence. Given that sex is an interpersonal act, it's an act between two persons, and we think it necessarily also brings in both parties' view about what respect the other party deserves. And so chastity whereas abstinence is simply not doing a certain activity, so you could abstain from sex simply by just not having sex. Chastity is more of a mindset that indicates a view about the human person which respects the dignity of the other person and see sex as meaningful because it involves another person. And chastity, whereas abstinence is part of the broader goal of chastity. So chastity, you might say, requires abstinence before marriage, but then chastity also continues throughout marriage by being faithful to one's spouse, by being respectful of one's spouse, etc. So just to get that distinction on the table.
Interesting. So let me ask you, I don't mean to dominate the conversation. I mean, if someone else wants to interject, feel free. I'm just curious. Interesting position. I think I remember reading that from an interview one of you had done somewhere on the web. I don't recall exactly where, that, you know, it's this relationship between two people, that sex deals with the dignity of both individuals. So let me ask you, I mean, this position you have on chastity rather than abstinence, how does masturbation interplay? Is there any interplay? I mean, are they even related?
I mean, so
okay, go ahead, Jordan.
Sorry. I was just going to say that the Anselm Society actually hasn't talked about masturbation in the recent past, so we don't have an official position on it. But with that being said, I don't know if anyone else has any comments they would like to offer.
Also, I think that part of the reason that we haven't approached it is because masturbation is not an interpersonal act, so we're just not generally what we're concerned with.
What seems to make sex so distinctive is something about the interpersonal nature of sex. And so we just sort of start out by thinking of sex as very interpersonal in this way, and so masturbation just sort of doesn't fit with what we generally talk about in the Anselm Society.
Gotcha.
All right, so I've kind of heard this a couple times now in different ways, so or maybe not in different ways, but in ways that I find connections. So one of the first things that was said was the idea that this hookup culture facilitates this emotional fallout because of hooking up with somebody, and there's no emotional investment, or there's an emotional investment on one person's side but not on another's. One person kind of always ends up getting hurt. Thus, there's a lack of respect for, I guess, the chastity. I don't know if that would be the appropriate way in which to use that term. But again, you said the inner, or you guys have said the interpersonal nature, which I think you can relate back to the idea that there's this emotional fallout. So is that the major premise on which you're saying that chastity is virtuous? Because
yeah,
you can't flourish if your emotions are in the gutter, I guess?
Yeah, I think that certainly, I think that the way to think about our position, and again, Anscombe like doesn't actually have any official philosophical justification for chastity. It's just a group of students who think that there's a problem with hookup culture, whatever you want to call it, and so it's just a matter of, well, how do we, you know, what's wrong, and how do we come to understand chastity through reason? But I think that certainly emotional damage caused by the hookup culture is bad, but I think that that's not kind of the ultimate starting point. But rather, it's that the emotional damage sort of points to a deeper truth about human sexuality as being significant for human beings. So that we have these emotional responses to sexuality, which can be very positive or negative in the case of some of the psychological damage that can be caused through bad relationships. But all of this sort of points to sexuality as something kind of integral to flourishing of a human being. So that ultimately it's that, this kind of deeper sense that we're using these sort of these kind of pieces of evidence as appealing to.
All right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, sort of jumping off of what David said, we think of sex as being an interpersonal unity, and so we think that, like, based in this interpersonal unity, the physical unity, there also have to be other types of unity. And so, like, if there isn't emotional unity, for instance, or then that's not really a true giving of the self, which is sort of how we see sex as a true giving of one person to another.
Okay.
Like, I don't know. One of the questions that pops into my mind is that there's varying different cultures of sex, and that people have very different views of it. And so I'm just curious, why is it the case that this view of sex being very much of giving yourself and having this very profound sense of giving yourself away to somebody? Why? I mean, is there some sort of outside of the philosophical realm? Maybe you guys have some sociological research that you could bring up. I was just curious, why is the definition of sexuality the dominant one that you're promoting, reporting, or using? I don't know if that was the right word.
So you're you want, you're looking for arguments other than philosophical ones for why sex should be viewed.
No. You can continue on the philosophical ones by all means. I was just curious. I don't feel that it was really nailed down or given much reason to why it's the case that sexuality has this profound emotional investment, because I don't believe that it's the case for everybody that they have a strong emotional investment in doing this. So I was just wondering, why is this view of sexuality the one that is general amongst all humans? Or is it just an intuitive argument? Are you just saying that you can have this intuition when you think about sex that thus and so you are giving yourself away?
Well, so I think that our intuitions definitely indicate that sex is somehow different from other types of interactions that we have, right? We think that there is some sort of sexual morality outside of conventional norms of honesty and contract keeping and consent. There are lots of times when things happen to me that I haven't consented to, right? Like someone would bump into me on the street, and I haven't consented to that. But it seems like in certain cases when you violate someone's sexual morality, say in rape, that there's something even worse at stake there. So our intuitions definitely indicate that sexual morality is somehow different. And then we think of sex as being different also because it's interpersonal, and so it requires a higher level of engagement.
And this is also certainly not to say that every act of sex involves both parties actually feeling this way. That's obviously not the case. But what we're saying is that when you look at over the long term, you could look at sociological data, people tend to react better when they're in a more, for example, a more stable relationship. You could say that you just look at human beings and they flourish better under conditions of stability, for example. So we're not saying that every instance of sex is like this, but we're saying over the long run, when you look at it across cultures and the way people react to it,
humans are just constituted in a way such that like they do best given these conditions. That's the argument that we're making.
Gotcha. An interesting point for our listeners. I mean, obviously you guys are all aware of this. David was sort of making, I'd like to make it more clear, is that they formed this group and now are supporting this group in response to a problem they saw, which in a way is sort of like anecdotal evidence. You know, they saw this happening on campus, this sort of fallout from the hookup culture. And they formed this group in response to that, to sort of counteract it. And as such, I mean, they don't require any specific faith background. They don't require any specific set of ideas, which is sort of twofold. Also, the reason why they don't have like a central well-driven argument, because it's a group of people. You know, this is like an idea they're forming together. So just so our listeners are aware, I mean, this isn't like it very well could be for some people, for an individual who's, let's say, Roman Catholic, they might feel that, you know, chastity is a good approach to life, but that is not necessitated by membership. I think I'm right in saying that, right, guys?
That's right. Yes.
Okay. We actually have a caller, so I think I'm going to go ahead and take their question at this time, and we'll see what they have to say.
Sure.
Hello, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hi, you guys. This is Radia.
Hi, Radia.
Hi.
Hey,
hi.
I'm enjoying. Hi, Princeton individuals. I just wanted to say that I'm enjoying the conversation, and I have to give you guys a thumbs up. I think
Thank
that
you.
What you're doing is awesome, because from my perspective, being, I would imagine, a lot older than all of you guys on the line, a lot of people are in your age group are not in that state of mind, and I think that it has caused chaos on the planet and in very negative ways. From my perspective, and I don't, when I say this, I'm not saying from a religious perspective, I'm saying this from a spiritual perspective, which overrides any religious doctrine. I really believe that we're all energy, you know, outside of our organic being, the body that we, you know, that we call ourselves. And, you know, the act of sex is very much a spiritual experience. And we are so willing as individuals to give our power away to anyone. They are literally entering your frame. And we're, you know, from my perspective, you're exchanging energy with someone, and people are so willing to give their power away. In essence, it has a tendency to dispower them and not to empower them. So I think it's very extraordinary that you guys have created a club of this and you're dealing with these issues and things of this nature. And I just have to give you guys an applause. I mean, my views are not completely in alignment with yours, but I think that abstaining to a certain extent and dealing with the issue of sex is very much important in your age category. So right on, you guys. You guys rock.
Thanks.
Thanks for your input, Radia. Insightful as always.
Thank you, sweetheart. I'm going to listen off the line and put myself on mute.
Okay. Take care.
Right.
We actually, this provides us a good opportunity to switch gears. I don't mean to, like, counteract the discussion we were having, but I'm just curious. I have this burning curiosity. What kind of reaction do you guys get, like, around campus?
I think So there are two reactions, or at least one reaction that's the hardest set, is that people often feel like we are judging them, that people who belong to Anscombe are somehow looking at the people around them who are living this way and thinking, oh, you're a bad person, I'm condemning you. And that's, I think that's the hardest part to overcome, because I can certainly understand how people in that position might feel that way, but the point of Anscombe is not to convert people, for example, to this point of view, because we think if not, they're bad people, for example, but it's more like we think that this is actually what would make you happier in the long run, so we're hoping this will help you become happier. We're doing this for your good as well. So I think that's the hardest part, is overcoming the sense that we're prejudiced against people who hold views different from ours.
Interesting.
I would like to just kind of accent on that, or I don't know, maybe give some support in that direction. One thing I'm very fond of doing as a philosophy student is kind of practicing Socratic method with people's political opinions. And so often when I'm asking them about their political opinions, they get very defensive and they feel that I'm judging them and they feel that I have opinions different than them. And I've been called a lot of very negative things when I haven't stated anything and I'm just merely asking them questions, including my own parents and very many other people, just from asking questions, you know. And it's not a matter that I'm judging what they're actually thinking about. It's a matter of I'm trying to understand, you know, and I just want to engage them, I guess, about their own ideas. And it's not a matter of judgment because, you know, I'm just me. What do I know? You know what I mean? So I think it's important that you guys do that regardless of, you know, and it doesn't sound like you're too hurt by it, you know. But it's good to get out there and engage people. I don't know. Just wanted to say that.
Yeah, you have to be pretty tough skin at Princeton, so, you know, you just get used to it. But
yeah, I assume that you'd have to have something of a thick skin. aspects of Central, this is a little bit tangential, but I'll throw it out there for you, the school that Nick and I attend, there are these people, I don't even know how you'd categorize them, maybe Nick would have a better way to do it, all of whom are sort of belong to some fundamental Christian group or another that will sort of stand around the sidewalks as we're walking between classes and literally tell passerby that they're going to hell because they're wearing a given outfit that's too revealing, or, you know, they'll make assumptions like, oh, you're all promiscuous, so you're all going to hell, or none of you attend church, you're all going to hell. To be clear, that's not what these students are doing, right, guys?
Yeah, no, definitely not.
That's good to hear.
We're trying to, approach, you know, we don't necessarily believe that, I mean, people are they're going to hell. I mean, again, like most people just, you know, don't really know, haven't thought about these issues or just, you know, whatever is the case. But we're trying to make, you know, the reasonable case that this is, you know, this is like, we think that this is like a path to a better life now, and not just, you know, like the future life to come or something, but that chastity is in fact an ideal that will lead to human flourishing, you know, right now.
And I think
so. Yeah.
One way that Anscombe differs very fundamentally from what you were describing as like sidewalk evangelization is that we're not simply telling people we think this is a better way to live. We're saying we want to open up a space where we can present all of these arguments and say, we think that once you see all this evidence and all these arguments, we hope that you'll come to the same conclusion that we have. So it's very much about respecting the other person's choices. We just want to provide them with all the information so that they make a choice that's best for them.
And I would say that we've definitely been perceived as a more reasonable sort of group on campus, even while people disagree with us, and even if they're afraid that we may be judging them, I think most people will say that Anscombe takes a very rigorous sort of approach to the issues that we talk about. And I think that's something that we've done right, if we're going about it by giving reasons and arguments rather than just asserting that this is the best way to live.
Yeah, that rules.
That would be my assessment, that you're definitely getting the job done, no doubt about it. So, I mean, if you haven't had enough pats on the back yet, here's one more. So let me ask you one more question before we get back into the boxing match. What is your membership like? I mean, I think just from my research on the internet, are you the original source of other groups I see at other campuses?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we were the first group of its kind founded, but what happened was after it was founded, one of the founding members of Anscombe went out and started the Love and Fidelity Network, which is a network of that connects all these groups across campuses that sprang up after Anscombe did. So it's, I mean, there is a network of groups. They all take slightly different approaches, but...
And so what the Love and Fidelity Network does is equip all of these different college campuses with resources, with arguments, with like speakers that they could turn to.
Ideas for events.
All of these sorts of things so that they can take and implement the Anscombe model on different college campuses.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'm satisfied. So let me ask you, you're getting back to sort of the heart of the issues of chastity and commitment and these sorts of things. I think that your general position, I realize I can't nail down a specific position because, I mean, it's not as though, you know, we're talking with a specific philosopher here. It's a group of people, again, I'd like to emphasize. You sort of state as a group that waiting until there's commitment or having commitment of equal levels in sexual or interpersonal relationships helps preserve dignity or maybe even autonomy. You haven't used that word. I don't know if I'm putting words in your mouth, but sort of like being on equal grounds, having sort of a committed, even relationship allows us to flourish better. Is that a fair summary?
I think so, but we also emphasize that there's more to it than just equality and consent. So, yeah,
okay.
We also see that sexual relationships should be permanent and they should be exclusive. So those are two additional conditions we would say.
Okay, so basically, in your thinking of traditional chastity, like you need to be married or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So let me ask you, I don't know if you can answer this question. It might be unfair. If so, that's perfectly okay. Is there some sort of substitute commitment that will do? I mean, if we have two people, let's say, for example, that are life partners, that, you know, are committed to each other, that are in, you know, a healthy, flourishing relationship, but have no interest in getting married in the traditional sense, I mean, what would your group's position be on that?
Sorry, so I think what makes marriage different is that marriage is, why is the state interested in marriage at all? The state's interested in marriage because marriage includes a sexual union that tends to produce children. And so the state is involved in regulating marriage because they want to provide the most stable framework for the rearing of children, the next generation of state citizens. So there could be other types of unions that that exist, like deep friendships between two people, maybe a civil union giving partnership to two different people, maybe me and my brother or something like that. And we would be okay with that. We just would question why the state would be interested in facilitating that type of union. Because it seems like the only reason the state is interested in a marriage union is because children might result from that sort of union.
Or, I think kind of, you know, you talked about, like, a marriage that hasn't been kind of formally, codified that way by the state or something. I think that two people were living in a place where, you know, like the last two people on Earth or something, or the first two, where there's you know, no laws or anything, like, and they're just kind of, you know, have this sort of commitment, quasi-marriage thing, you know, is that really marriage? And I'd say that it is, that what's essential to marriage is this kind of vow of permanence and exclusivity, and that the state sort of formalizes and sort of upholds this kind of makes public what is kind of this private interpersonal decision. But yeah, I mean, it's difficult. The question I would say is, well, you know, why wouldn't this couple want to have like a public recognition of their marriage? Are they like perhaps not really committed to each other? In that case, it doesn't really seem like it'd be a marriage because they could just leave whenever they wanted to. But it's kind of tricky hypothetical situation. But
I don't know how exactly this is gonna flush out. But I don't have, you know, it's kind of like a buzz statistic, I guess, that, you know, like 50% of marriages end in divorce. You know, I come from a divorced family, and I think that turned out all right. But in any case, like, how is it the case that, you know, you make this exclusive commitment to somebody that you know is going to work out and have this lasting effect? I mean, there seems to be a lot of faith involved that it will work out and that these things will work out. Yeah. So, I mean, how does that kind of address that issue? So, I mean, are you being unchaste if, you know, you believe that it's going to work out, it doesn't work out, you know, move on, you go and you find another partner, and then that one doesn't work out either. I mean, is it possible for somebody to have really bad luck and still remain chaste? I don't know if that's a fair question.
The way that we think about marriage is that it requires going into it with the mindset of it being both permanent and exclusive. So you have to realize that, like, there will be a chance that things might not always be ideal. And barring some, like, really exceptional situations like domestic abuse, we would say that you should still maintain that level of commitment because of your pledge to permanence and exclusivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But how does that deal with one's flourishing, you know? If, like, one wants to flourish beyond where their partner is really letting them kind of live in, how do they get beyond that without... it seems like a conflict amongst which ways you want to flourish. Do you want to flourish in the sense of self-control and willpower to overcome something that you believe is having a negative effect on your life for the sake of remaining chaste, or should you not want to do that?
I mean, what seems to make marriage and sex different from other types of just like exercising your autonomy is that there's another person involved. And so when there's another person involved, it can't just be all about your own personal autonomy. It's also about this thing that you've both committed to, this marriage.
Yeah, I mean...
So there's kind of like a... And I mean, and this is another pretty philosophical, I think, interesting... And perhaps, I don't know if it's true or not, but that once one finds themselves in a relationship, we can assume like a marriage-style relationship, that there is a loss of autonomy. Is that fair to say, given what we're talking about?
Maybe, could you define autonomy for us? I'm just having...
Like self-government, the willingness to choose one's own life path to define one's existence, I guess.
Right, so we think of marriage something slightly different from that. So we don't think of choosing your partner as just being like choosing something else, like choosing a vehicle. You know, people sort of make the analogy like, well, why would I buy a car if I haven't test-driven it yet? And so we definitely reject that conception. When you're entering into a marriage, it's just a different type of union. So you may lose some of your ability to choose later on, but
I don't know if I just want to stop you real quick just to slow you down. I don't know if you're making the assumption that when I'm saying loss of autonomy, I'm saying the loss of the choice of being able to choose another partner to sleep with. But I'm saying loss of autonomy in marriage would be like, I don't know, I can't pick up and take off to India and study with some Hindu sheikh or something, you know? I don't know. That's kind of maybe a kind of bad example. But let's say you have this lifelong goal of doing such, you know, and there would be no way of doing it provided that you had this marriage. So I don't know.
But I mean, that's certainly a concept. I mean, you see that a lot when two people are thinking about getting married, and you know, say they have competing career goals, and the idea is, am I willing to sacrifice, or are we willing to compromise
right.
their career goals? So I think that's
just much better. I just wanted to kind of move it outside of the realm of sex, because I think we're just making a point about autonomy right now, and not about the sex stuff. So good point.
Did you want to continue along that line of two people having
yeah.
sex? Okay. I mean,
I was just working at the general principle, I guess.
Sure. So when you enter into a relationship or commitment like marriage with someone, I think you do have to go in with your eyes open, knowing that you are giving up some of your freedom because you are rejecting some options and making the choice that you're going to stay with this person, and that you being a unit will require you making compromises, since now you have another person to think about when you're making your plans, for example.
So the thought is that, like, by being in that relationship and even in the giving up of some types of choices that you're no longer able to make, you're still going to experience, like, a net gain in flourishing from being in that relationship over the long term.
And hopefully you won't enter that relationship unless you believe that.
All right. So, I mean, as long as you guys are comfortable with hypotheticals, it seems you are. I realize that, you know, you can't speak from doctrine or anything like that. But let me add a layer of abstraction or hypothetical for you. What about societies, you know, within cultures that we know that don't really recognize an institution of marriage or long-term commitment, but still have this interpersonal sexual relationship? I guess what I'm trying to say is, what about cultures that see sex as something other than what our intuition seem to be? Because I agree with your assessment of intuition. I mean, the three of you have said, well, we have this intuition that, you know, when you're having sex with someone, that this is somehow like a bigger connection than... I completely slaughtered that. You made such an eloquent point, and I destroyed it. But I think your intuition is right. I mean, I agree with you that, you know, sex seems to be something more, I don't know the right word, delicate maybe. What about a society that disagrees with that intuition? I mean, what would you say to them?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, obviously it's kind of like a case-to-case basis. Like, you just, there's no, you know, a priori kind of thing to say. It would just be, you know, examining what the culture believes. But I think, in general, it's unclear, you know, that, say, we can take, say, an example of, like, you know, the oft-used example of, like, Aztec human sacrifice or something.
Okay.
You know, it seems, at first glance, that, you know, the Aztec's intuition about human life, value of human life, was radically different from ours.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't actually think that's the case. There's just a difference in kind of the ordering or ranking of goods, because it's not that the Aztecs didn't value human life. They thought it was just they needed to make the sunrise the next day, and so the value of human life was subordinated to some religious impulse. But if this kind of cosmological picture of making the sunrise is removed from that culture, I think that they would share some of our basic intuitions. And similarly about sex, that, you know, in say, cultures that have, widespread polygamy, you know, perhaps it's just due to some religious belief, which is kind of, I mean, difficult to know what to say because it's, you know, an article of faith. And it's also unclear, you know, to what extent people are sort of willingly entering into polygamous relationships and not just kind of going along with particular societal norms. So this is kind of what I'd say generally. But
we also want to say something about how the reason that we propose this as being the best way of human flourishing is because we've looked at the way people live. If people were constituted differently, we would have a different sexual ethic. So it's based in the way that humans are. We're rational creatures, but we're also more than rational creatures, and we have these interpersonal unions with other people, and so these confer certain obligations on us.
I'd also be interested to hear if, like, there was an actual example of a society that didn't have some concept of binding permanent relationships of a sexual nature, because, I mean, part of what we're saying is that this is a fact, this is something about, like, how humans are. So we're not saying that this is the way that, for example, every sexual organism is. If we came across some alien culture where they didn't appear to have this kind of concept, then maybe we'd have to take a look at how they were constituted and what types of beings they were. So we are making an argument particular to humans. And I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, do you have any societies in mind that did not have this concept? Or
some similar concept of binding children to their parents? Because it seems like this is necessary for a society to rear the next generation of children.
Yeah, there's a view in tantric sex, which is it moves away from the interpersonal nature, like, and this is strictly looking at sex. I don't know what tantric's view of relationships is, but I'm thinking of a book called The Heart of Tantric Sex, which the author, I don't have it in front of me, which the author talks about. It's actually a very personal experience, and it's all about, it's basically essentially meditation through sex. And in the book, she talks about having several partners and how it can be a very healthy thing. So I mean, that's one, you know, view of somebody else, you know, and I do know people who are in a marriage situation that do, quote unquote, swing, and they seem entirely happy and have been married for over 20 years. So, I mean, I do think there is counterexamples where it seems to work out. And these people, I believe, have to very much remain under the radar because they would be looked at as a sexual deviant. And again, I think this is why me and Mike have both kind of brought this point up, is we have this sort of intuition thinking that, well, there's the last two shows we did were in culture, identity, and ideology. And so I think part of our minds are already in this kind of gear of thinking about, well, how is our ideology formed? How do we get these thoughts of what a social norm is and what our intuitions of sex are? And it seems very much dictated by our culture and so on. In the way that I think that me and Mike have kind of been pulled towards this culture, which I can't point to a particular culture that condones sex without some sort of emotional investment other than tantric sex, which is more of an idea of how to have sex, not anything having to do with relationships. And it seems that, and I wanted to say this, that, you know, I've had several conversations with my friends and kind of just on my own before this about, and basically the question comes down to, if you're having sex with a person, do you have to be in a relationship with them? And the intuition is definitely, yes, you have to be in a relationship with them. So I think the intuition's right on, but where does that intuition come from? Is it from our fundamental makeup as a human being? I don't know. I don't know if I can really make that jump. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, I think obviously it's a pretty difficult question, like, you know, the origin of our moral intuitions.
Right,
but,
right.
I mean, in my opinion, I mean, I think that our moral norms are too very large extent socially constructed, but that doesn't mean that they're arbitrary or, for that matter, false.
No, I don't think that either.
Much
no.
Like, I think, I think that, you know, sex is sort of part, relationships are kind of part kind of biology or physical, psychological constitution, and also kind of part social performance, our ways, our norms of thinking about sex are interpretations of our nature as human beings. And so it's not a matter of, like, that our moral norms just immediately reflect human nature. They can be distorted various ways. And it's just the task of philosophical reasoning to try to, as much as possible, sort of disengage ourselves from our particularities and look at other cultures, look at other philosophical positions, and try to take a sort of a step back. There's no ultimate end to the process of moral inquiry.
David, your point is well received. I liked when you said interpretation of human nature, as though, like, who's to say, you know, that one has it right or another does without the discourse,
right.
Which is sort of one of the major themes of our show, is like it's through discourse that, you know, we sort of get closer to the penultimate. And as you mentioned, there really is no end to moral inquiry.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd agree. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, of course, I mean, no, you know, interpretation, which is just, you know, they're not all equal or anything like that. It's just, you know, the kind of best, you know, the best argument so far is the best interpretation, the one that's able to sort of solve some of the difficulties in other positions. But there's no a priori reason or that you know, the best interpretation yet may not be superseded by another one. So.
I think I'd have to say that I absolutely agree with you. To sort of rewind a little bit, and I think you may have already responded to this, David, at least in part, but I think it was Shivani. I'm sorry if I'm wrong. It may have been Lauren. I apologize. I wasn't paying very close attention. Who said, you know, we're talking about humans here, you know, not like some other animal or some other species or something like that, but it's part of human nature. And, you know, Nick sort of responded with this idea of tantric sex. Well, I can't point to a specific society, you know, but I am aware of specific tribes, various Aboriginal tribes, where sex is seen as a very ordinary, informal thing. That's not to say that it's entirely without bonds. You know, I'm sure there still would be bond, but I'm talking about, you know, a specific tribe of maybe several hundred people in which, you know, it's sort of like a duty for progeny of the tribe, if that makes sense. It's sort of like the tribe is a family rather than one specific mom and dad. Does that make sense? They sort of like replace the concept of, you might say that in that way they're committed. I'm interested to see what your intuitions about that are.
So is this the case where both men and women have multiple spouses?
Right.
So in that case, it seems as though there's still some idea of needing to bind children to something, to parents, or to some group that is going to rear the children. And
right.
We would think that normally sex brings two people together because there can be two people involved, like the union is sort of between two persons at any one time and is directed towards the procreation, or, you know, it's directed towards the production of children. So in that sense, it sort of fits with some of our intuitions, although I'd be really interested to see whether or not children from that society just fared as well sociologically as sort of children in a normal two-parent home, because that does seem quite different from, like, the everyday intuitions we have about the best framework for rearing children. And social science seems to indicate that the best framework is with two biological parents.
It's certainly not the only framework within which children can flourish, but it's like overall this
right.
seems to be the most conducive.
Like for instance, like people often point to the kibbutz system as a you know like a group of people trying to raise children in common. But I mean, a large part of why that has been on the decline is because it wasn't as successful as people thought it would be.
Interesting. You know, and you said you'd like to like see some sociological data and sort of compare how the children match up. And I was thinking, as you know, David was talking about the Aztecs, and you know, maybe it's some sort of religious belief that gets in the way of their views of the sanctity of life, or you know, maybe there's something else we don't understand. I was thinking, you know, it's too bad we don't have an Aztec here and to ask, you know. But I think the same sort of thought applies, you know. In one sense, you would like to see, you know, how Aboriginal children, you know, compare from a specific tribe I'm talking about. I'm sure no such data exists. But even still, you know, they're being brought up to do things like, you know, hunt bison with spears, you know, as opposed to going to school. And so it may not be a fair comparison. But
I don't think you could do a comparative study in that sense because, like you're saying, the starting conditions are just so different that it wouldn't be a valid comparison. But
I think you're right. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. You can finish your thought.
I do have some sense, you know, you said it seems like there's still a commitment here, like there's still some sort of group which is raising the children and it replaces, you know, the traditional mother and father. I'm tempted to agree with you in that assessment. I mean, I think that they're, you know, sort of like languages can vary, but still, I don't know if you guys are familiar with linguistics or not, but there's an argument to be made by some people that, well, languages seem totally different. there still seem to be basic rules which they all follow. I think that sort of the same analogy would apply here, that it does seem to be, even within, you know, these specific tribes I'm talking about, that there's still some sense of commitment or bond or child rearing. It's just not specific to two people as we would see it. That's all.
So it seems that there are still some norms that apply specifically to sex. And even in the Aboriginal case, it seems like if there is a community that's raising children, there are some norms that are specific to that union about how children are raised and dealt with. And so while we think that these norms might not be the correct ones, we could say that, you know, at least they share our intuition about there being norms specific to sexuality.
All right. I guess I just want to kind of bring up the point, like, it seems like the family plays a very important role in the argument that chastity is important. Am I okay in saying that?
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
All right. And given that, and given the level at which society is at now, and again, we're like kind of saying, well, it's kind of weird to compare, you know, this ancient tribe to where we're at now, or some tribe even currently that lives, you know, in the middle of the rainforest versus that lives in, you know, suburban Michigan. I think, you know, I agree, it's very hard to compare. But to kind of throw another little element into the mix that I think we should be cognizant of is that it's the case that pretty much now, you know, you can guarantee, you know, provided that you have two responsible adults engaging in sex with, you know, a condom and birth control, I think you're pretty good, you know what I mean? Probabilistically that there's not going to be a baby on the way. And so given that level of freedom that is now there to be had with sex and to explore one's sexuality, I guess the biological constraint of having a child being kind of removed, I don't know, then the family seems to kind of take a you know, on the back burner, like, well, if that's a decision, we'll cross that bridge when we decide that we want to have children, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Seems like the reason that the state is involved at all in regulating this sort of institution is because of the children. So even if, in a lot of cases, children might not actually result, all the conditions beforehand are being met for children to result, even if there are some sort of other things at play that may reduce the probability of that. That's why the state's interested. So,
yeah, it's the type of union. For example, even if a given couple happens to be infertile, it's the type of union that would normally result in children, so that's why the state's interested.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the state's like, you know, I mean, I agree, you know, I think the state's definitely trying to do something like that, but then you look at the results of what's real about marriage, and it's like, well, 50% of them last and 50% of them don't. I don't have that statistic right in front of me. It's kind of a statistic that I've just heard throughout my, like, for a while now. I don't know, I guess I can look, I should probably look that up. But in any case, it's like, so, I mean, yeah, marriage, I think, you know, is supposed to serve that role, but what does it really serve? I think it just serves as another platform on which, you know, people claim a close relationship. And so I don't know it's how that fits into the argument, but I just have to make that relevant again.
Sure. I mean, I don't think it's, what we're arguing is not necessarily to say that marriage in all its forms right now is the best case. For example, in some cultures today, you would have arranged marriages. Now, we, of course,
right,
would prefer, and, you know, those were legal, valid marriages. But obviously, we would say we would prefer that in those cases, often the two parties did not necessarily know each other beforehand. And we would say, well, of course, we would prefer, like, if the two parties knew each other. So I say marriage as it currently exists may not be the ideal form of it. So like you were saying, if there's a 50% divorce rate, and maybe that indicates that there's something
wrong with the way that we conceive of marriage today. Yeah.
Okay.
So, interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say that just the way that society generally conceives of marriage, just because that's the way it currently happens to be, and if you look at the data that says there's a 50% divorce rate, then that is also good evidence that perhaps we should reconsider the way that we perceive marriage. So,
interesting.
I think, yeah. What you were saying about intuition earlier, it's like, that's what a lot of how Hanscom first started was, you would see the situation, you saw something was not quite right, and so then you want to take a deeper look into it. So I think that's the role our intuitions have to play, is initially bringing this problem to our attention, and then you can use more philosophical methods to investigate what exactly the problem is.
I was just sort of going to let this die down, but I actually have done some scholarly work recently on divorce rates and this type of thing. And it seems to keep coming up, so I just wanted to throw out there the current scholarly consensus, if there is one. It's still sort of a heated debate, but, you know, among those people who are respected and, you know, peer-reviewed and this sort of thing, divorce rates have never hit 50%. Where that statistic comes from is in one given year, there was half the number of divorces as there were marriage in that specific year, if that makes sense. There were, let's say, a million marriages and 500,000 divorces in a given year. And a person improperly inferred from this, and it sort of hit the media, and then we got this buzzword that Nick is referring to. Divorce rates have hit, you know, up into the high 30s, low 40s, this sort of thing. But they do appear to be declining. So I don't know if that affects it at all or not. But it's hanging right now around one-third of most marriages will end in divorce is the prediction. Of course, we know we can't know that, but the statistics has never hit 50%.
Okay.
So let me ask you, that notwithstanding, I think I know how you respond to this, but what would you say to someone, I know someone specifically, who feels as though, this is a young lady I know, that commitment has more of a negative effect on her life. I don't know that she'd specifically say, like, it breaches her autonomy. But, you know, she has described to me in the past that, you know, she feels as the relationship should be very sort of open and informal, and that, you know, commitment has done more bad for her than good. I mean, I can't argue her position for her, and I think you might certainly, you know, say something, well, what about in the long run, or that sort of thing. But what would you say to a person or people who come at you with that attitude? Like, you know, the sex is an expression of freedom. You know, it's something I do, and yeah, it's interpersonal, but, you know, it doesn't create a lasting bond, and, you know, I still do fine without this lasting bond. What would you say to them?
Well, yeah, I'd say, I mean, first of all, it depends on, you know, how you define freedom and autonomy. And, you know,
right.
Like, you know, it seems, you know, I would say that, I mean, freedom isn't just doing whatever you want. I mean, that's just sort of like, seems to me just kind of a shallow ideal of freedom, but I mean, there's kind of this also positive sense of freedom. Like, you know, if you, and in fact, the particular constraints can help you achieve particular ends. Like, you know, the rules of grammar enable you to say meaningful things. Are they constraints upon you? Well, I mean, in some sense, but they also are things that enable you to be able to communicate with other people. So I think that marriage is, yes, I mean, you're closing off other things you could do with your life, other relationships that you could have with people, but you're also opening up positively avenues for personal fulfillment, growth, indeed joy. And I think that, you know, it. So I think that's the freedom that marriage brings. It's this freedom to participate in this deeply fulfilling type of relationship.
And bringing it back to the idea of flourishing, the idea of freedom is only meaningful insofar as you have an idea of what it is for you to flourish. So in that sense, freedom is not the freedom to, like what David was saying, simply to do whatever you want. It's the freedom to pursue a certain concept, I guess, of how you see yourself being happy. So if for this particular person, she doesn't think that at a given moment, having a committed sexual relationship would bring her to be the type of person that she wants to be, then I think we'd certainly be okay with that. It's not like commitment is good in and of itself. It's good when it's directed towards certain goals. And what the Anselm Society is trying to say is certain goals are more likely to help you be a happier person in the long run. So it's not an endorsement of this type of commitment across the board, regardless of the circumstances. But we hope that, like, when people look at this and say, okay, making these certain types of commitments are probably going to help me more than other types of commitments.
Well, We have about 2 minutes, and I would just like to say this has been awesome to do this again. This is good. But I've been wanting to make this analogy for a while, and it seems it goes back to the very first point of the kind of emotional investment that sexuality takes. And I know that this might be a stretch to say, but provided that you get in a romantic relationship with somebody without sex, that you abstain from sex even though you're in a relationship with this person, and you find yourself very much in the lines of, you know, what you would consider love with this person, provided that that person leaves you, I mean, it's going to be hard. You know, you're emotionally invested regardless. The emotional investment occurs when you start to make this romantic move towards them, and whatever that means. I mean, we could probably go on about that for a great deal of time. But I guess my point is like, so where do you draw the line on, like, how do you distinguish, I guess, you know, because some people don't associate that emotional investment with sex, and if two people are in that same boat and they're responsible adults, I don't see how your arguments play into that.
Unfortunately, we don't quite have time to entertain that. But
right, I'm sorry. Shouldn't
it's
I
okay.
Yeah.
You know, we're left with some interesting questions. I think we're actually off the air now, but this will go into the archives. This has been the Anscombe Society that we're interviewing from Princeton. We've had members David, Lauren, and Shivani, all of whom are very articulate and exactly the sort of people we'd like to have on the show. So we want to thank you guys so much for being with us and having this discussion. You know, some great stuff. We could easily do, you know, 10 more shows on this sort of topic. You guys all came very well prepared. I feel like I should have had more devil's advocate ammunition to throw at you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks
yeah,
for having
absolutely.
Us. Pleasure.
You guys take care and have a great summer.
Yeah, thank you.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.